Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are you tough enough to be an archaeologist? They often work in remote, uncomfortable, or downright dangerous environments, chasing buried treasure in the form of clues about human history. Undeterred by the low pay and inhospitable working conditions, many archaeologists seem to be motivated by something like addiction. Every new shovel full of earth could be the one that yields a fresh and important insight into a long-forgotten past. Author Marilyn Johnson trekked around the globe to immerse herself in this fascinating and obsessive subculture, even attending field school so she could go to digs as an active participant rather than an observer. She writes about her experiences in her new book, Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Marilyn, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Archaeologists do, on occasion, unearth objects that have significant financial value, but this book really drives home that what they're actually seeking is information.
That's right. They're looking, they need to find things in context so they can learn as much about it as possible. And this was something really interesting to me. What they think is treasure is the intellectual things that they learned from these often pieces and fragments of pottery.
So let's talk a little bit more about context. You really do need to find things and examine them around what else exists there. And can you explain why that matters so much?
Well, if you have an object that someone just hands to you and you don't know where it came from, they frequently cannot date it. And they don't know how to place it in the world. It's really very difficult. So when you see the way things are arranged in a grave, for instance, or in the foundation of an old building, or you see what somebody has thrown on a garbage pile from thousands of years ago, it tells you so much more about the people, what they value, and what survives.
A garbage pile turns out to be a really amazing source of information.
This is, I mean, really where archaeologists work mostly is in graves and garbage pits. And, I mean, you know, to say that that's your workplace is really kind of gross.
So much of their work relies on conjecture. Can you talk about what they do to understand the materials and the tools the people worked with and how they might have been put to use?
Well, if you are digging as an archaeologist or with an archaeological team in a place from, say, the 18th century, digging on an old sugar plantation, as I did in the book, you have to know all the parts that go into a sugar plantation. You have to know how people processed sugarcane and turned it into, for instance, rum. If you don't recognize those little conical things that fit on top of those urn-shaped things, then you're not going to know what you find.
What was amazing about that experience as I was reading about it was the way that you can take the objects that you find and then put them up against whatever historical records might exist. And when you're dealing with people who've been kept in slavery, it's not the history books that tell you the clues. It's like primary documents from the time.
Oh, yes. That's sort of one of the interesting and complicated things about digging in the recent past, in the past where there are some kind of written record. You just have a tremendous amount of things that you have to know and that you have to go through in order to understand what it is that you're finding. And the archaeologist I was digging with, this was in the Caribbean, was actually finding out that the people who were enslaved on this particular island were leading a sort of interesting double life. I mean, they were doing all the crummy work at the sugar plantation, but they were also participating in the black market and profiting from it, sometimes enough to actually buy their freedom.
How did you decide on that field school experience that you had in the Caribbean?
Well, I considered, scores of options. There are so many places to dig in the world, so many places where people are actually welcoming volunteers or students who are willing to pay to go. And this particular place did not involve crawling in a very small space in a tomb, did not involve working with human bones, which I felt a little squeamish about, and sounded like the kind of place where they wouldn't expect me to stay for 8 weeks and do 12-hour days in the hot sun. I mean, it was a little bit more accommodating of somebody who would come in for a couple of weeks instead of a couple of months.
What kind of training did you receive?
The price was right. Yeah. I mean, you know, at that point it was $500 a week. And I thought, well, they won't judge me because I don't know what I'm doing. They'll train me and teach me how to do what I need to do. And in fact, I guess I'm kind of hapless. I made every mistake in the book.
To be clear, the $500 a week was not what you were receiving. It was, in fact, what you were paying to stay there and to work.
Oh, you don't get paid for this. No, you pay. You pay. And in fact, I'm speculating that, you know, some of these digs really count on that money that people who are just crazy to have an experience out at an excavation, what they bring to the table, that actually helps fund the excavation.
What does it take to get permission to dig in a site that an archaeologist believes might have important artifacts?
Oh, it depends on where. And if it is in another country, it can be tremendously complicated. And in fact, I was running into archaeologists who would, you know, get funding, put a team together, actually have done tremendous amounts of research, be all set, know exactly where they wanted to dig. And then they would sit around cooling their heels waiting for the foreign government to give them permission to dig there. And it's held up more than one excavation that I know about, getting all the ducks lined up so you can actually find out something. And then what if there's nothing there? I mean, it's just incredible. Well, as one archaeologist said, there's never nothing there. But I hand it to them. I mean, you know, the legal requirements in the United States are actually very strict. And it depends on what state you're in and how you're, you know, whether you have permission from the State Historic Preservation Office and the oversight of that office to do it. A tremendous amount of legal requirements.
There's a tremendous amount of physical labor involved as well that people may not be fully aware of.
Oh, it's, you know, I describe them as, at some point, as they're kind of like pirates. I mean, the older archaeologists that you meet, you know, they limp, they have weird scars, they have sun damage, and, you know, and they're characters, too. I mean, they're just completely self-entertaining. You know, often they're out in a remote area and there's not a whole lot to do at night. So they sit around telling stories and drinking cheap beer.
Seems like most of the folks that you met and worked with really absolutely target one particular era in history. So you might have two archaeologists working alongside each other and one's looking at, you know, 400 years ago and one's looking at 40,000 years ago.
Absolutely. And many sites, of course, are multi-sites. You know, there are places where somebody in ancient times would have left their trace, and then somebody much more recently, you know, a couple thousand years ago, and then somebody, 500 years ago. And so you would have a team of archaeologists, some of whom would be more expert in the older archaeology, the paleoarchaeology, and others who would be much more comfortable with medieval times. People fall in love with an era or they fall in love with a culture. And it's a mysterious process. Why are some people crazy about the Nazca? Well, they're fascinating people who lived in Peru and did bizarre things with, shrunken heads. And their pottery was wacky. So that might be a reason you would fall in love with them. But other people are just crazy about the Moche. And, you know, they like their pottery. I don't know. It's very interesting. And I tried to get a range of archaeologists, some who were interested in the oldest traces of Homo sapiens and some who were interested in the archaeology of 5 minutes ago.
I liked learning about John Shea, who is, it seems like part of his mission in life is to remind us that our distant ancestors were not primitive at all. They were incredibly smart.
Well, you know, and it's interesting why we have this idea that because we know how to use a smartphone, we are superior to anybody who doesn't, older people or even people from earlier times, when in fact, John Shea was my teacher, and he's really interested in the Ice Age. He is more than anybody else, though they all feel this way. The people who preceded us on this planet were geniuses. They were adaptive in ways that we are just now beginning to understand. They were survivalists, of course. They could do a million different things. They were not, you know, in these narrow little niches like we are. We know how to drive a car, we can use a smartphone, and then we have one little task, which is our job in life. You know, these people could do everything.
The detail that he brought out that has really stuck with me since reading this book is the idea that, like, in the Stone Age, you don't have a permanent home. So you might be able to invent 15 awesome purpose-made tools for the things you need to do, but you can't carry that stuff with you. So you have to find something that can do the job for everything.
Yeah, you have to be portable, and it's really important to be portable in Ice Age times because humans were prey. I mean, you know, there were a number of different species that liked to stalk and eat humans, and so they were living in very hostile circumstances. And so, you know, they had to be able to run, and they had to be able to run fast. And they had to, if they, you know, buried the tools that they couldn't carry with them, they had to be able to find them again or bury the food that they were setting aside. They had to figure out how to preserve it and figure out how to find it and figure out how to secure it from animals who would have eaten it, you know, happily.
When you're looking at graves, Marilyn, obviously bodies by many cultures were buried deliberately, and you just mentioned burying tools, but how do other artifacts get buried over time, get left there, and how long does it take to sort of have something completely covered by the earth?
It doesn't take that long at all. I mean, in most places, I will say that. It's interesting how much the climate change is affecting archaeology because as the oceans are rising and the permafrost is melting and the superstorms or storms are coming through, you're getting the crust of the earth really whipped up, exposed in some places, buried in others. And what ends up popping up in places where they've never seen, for instance, archaeological remains, way at the top of mountain ranges or way up by the Arctic Circle, what pops up are organic remains of, for instance, hunter-gatherers. And, you know, this is a whole new phase of archaeology. We've had mummies and bog bodies, you know, which have been weirdly preserved, and so there is some tissue there. But it's becoming more and more frequent that we are actually finding something that is not, comfortably removed and petrified.
We're speaking this hour with author Marilyn Johnson. Her new book is called Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Marilyn Johnson. Her new book is Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. What did it take to learn to dig properly at an archaeological site?
Well, basically, they can show you what they need you to do in a few minutes. And you get prepared. You kneel down in a, usually a really warm, uncomfortable environment. You remove the top layer of soil in a very clear pattern, a 1 meter square. This is called a test unit or a test pit. And you lift off the top of that soil, and then you very carefully and in a controlled way dig down a little bit and lift the shovel up and then sift it in one of these big sifters that you can rock back and forth. And anything that comes up, you want to be sure that you record where it was that it was found, where this nail was found, where this bone was found, where this little piece of pottery, and that's pretty much it. And so that's like sounds incredibly boring, but in fact it is. I was describing doing it in the Caribbean. It was like, the tropics were ready to attack you at any moment. The foliage is growing at a crazy rate. You have insects crawling all over, and you have the incredible suspense of lifting that next bit of dirt. Usually, you have a very good idea of the history of the plot of ground that you are examining. Somebody has done a thorough, search of all the documents and everything that they can find out about this ground before they actually touch it and go into it. And there are some theories about where the foundations of the house might have been, where the gathering place, the campfire might have been. And so you want to find out, well, is this where the hearth was, where they were cooking, then where do you dig? They can stand around discussing these things for hours. But what you are actually doing as a participant is stupefyingly boring if you did not have the suspense of finding something out. And I try to describe it. It is addictive. It is thrilling to find a little piece of pottery that someone from 500 years earlier might have touched.
And sometimes you would find things and you weren't quite sure what you had found, and you'd either be told, yes, this is something, or no, this is probably just a hermit crab shell or something.
Well, they know a whole lot more than I do, so they could tell that most of what I had separated out as potentially interesting was garbage. It was just rocks. It was not of interest. But to me, it's really hard to tell some of these things. And I would have an archaeologist pick something up and say, do you see this edge right here? This was not made in nature. This was humans made this edge right here. I'm thinking, okay, if you say so. But it's very subtle reading of the clues that they are mostly doing. And, I mean, it must be thrilling for people to actually pull up, a golden necklace, Wow, that would be really cool. I think those people are very rare. And the golden necklaces, that would really complicate a lot of the issues that I wanted to discuss. It's the gold, then everybody goes crazy. And I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the really humble finds.
So what happens to those objects? Because the golden necklace, would be in some Blockbuster museum exhibit maybe eventually. Mm-hmm. But little shards of pottery, you don't put them back in the ground, right? But there can't
right.
be space to store. Are they all cataloged and stored somewhere?
Oh, what a good question. Yes. In fact, our planet is littered with storage spaces that are crammed with what has been dug up from archaeological expeditions. If you're a doctoral candidate and you want to do and you want to find out about, you know, fragments that might have come from the ground, you can go into these storage spaces and examine the fragments. Most of them sit there in storage forever.
Do you have to handle them with gloves? It's funny to think that they're, you know, they're underground and they're dirty and dusty, and then suddenly mm-hmm. they're recognized to be a precious object.
Yes, they're cleaned. They are studied. They are categorized. They are written up, and often, you know, the information about them is published, and they are stored. And archaeologists have a responsibility for everything that they dig up. They're supposed to maintain that responsibility in perpetuity. You're supposed to be able to go back and get that stuff. That's, obviously, it doesn't work that way. But one of the archaeologists that I followed actually has made fantastic discoveries in his storeroom, in his museum storeroom, because he went in there and found these pots and scraped up and analyzed the residue that was in the bottom of them and discovered a different kind of alcoholic beverage than one that you can find on the shelves of our liquor stores. He found something that was like a combination of honey mead and beer.
Which didn't sound very appetizing to you when you heard the combination, but this turns out to be the sort of thing that is really exciting when you put a conference of archaeologists together.
Mm-hmm. Well, he issued a challenge to craft beer maker to help him reverse engineer this residue and try to recreate the beverage. This in particular residue happened to be found in the tomb of King Midas, or possibly King Midas's uncle. They were never really quite clear about that. And they recreated a beer called Midas Touch. And it did sound disgusting. I mean, it did not sound really very good to me, but I got to try it with this guy. And the best way I can describe it is liquid pound bread. It was so delicious and actually, it turns out, fattening. But that's called experimental archaeology. And, it's trying to recreate the conditions that are that the people who've gone before us, might have experienced.
You write that the future of archaeology lies underwater. Why is that?
Well, that's just what a ton of archaeologists told me. Because the oceans are rising, because they're drowning sites that used to be above ground, and because so much of human life now crosses the oceans. I mean, archaeologists are interested anywhere humans have left their trace. So now they're going to be interested in a comet. Really, they are. They're interested in the garbage that, circles around space, where we've left our mark. So the oceans we've left, I mean, there are shipwrecks, there is garbage, there are all kinds of things that can be found underwater. And a lot of it settles under the silt there and is thus protected from degradation.
Of course, those excavations are going to be not only more complicated, but vastly more expensive than anything on dry land.
Oh, yes. Yes, and will involve, getting wet.
And there are people who strictly focus on underwater archaeology.
Oh, yes. It's quite a growing field and a fascinating one as well, because, so much of our history, we think we know it all. We think it's all understood in books. It is not all understood by such a long stretch. And one of the archaeologists I followed was an underwater archaeologist, and her area of interest right now is in Newport Harbor, Rhode Island, where she has found a place where a fleet of British ships were sunk deliberately during the Revolutionary War. And, the residue of the ships are still under the harbor there. And one of them turns out to be renamed and refitted, but in its earlier incarnation, the first ship to go around the world with Captain Cook.
Wow. We have an email here, a tweet from Stephen, who wants to know, if an archaeological find or fossil is discovered on private land, is the owner of the land the owner of the find?
Oh, what a good question. In the United States, why your private owner rules. And your private owner is not supposed to destroy archaeological heritage and certainly not supposed to build on graves, but that's his land and that's his stuff.
And when there are construction projects undertaken, sometimes an archaeologist is called in. Is that because in certain places local law requires it?
Well, yes, and if it's near something that's a known archaeological feature, as part of the environmental assessment of the land, every state has a state historic preservation office that will want to know whether, you know, valuable archaeological remains are going to be disturbed by the project. Certainly, if the project involves federal dollars or federal land, then one has an obligation to preserve that archaeology.
Which is not to say
that's ideally.
It's not to say that things can never be built over what turns out to be a valuable site. They just have to be excavated first. Is that right?
Well, that's a mitigation, and sometimes an emergency archaeology is how it happens. But I was at this great hotel in, I think, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and it turned out to be built on an archaeological site. And what they had done was they had just built an area in the basement around this site, and they had a display window, and they had, you know, information about what had been dug up. And so, you know, incorporating that archaeology into whatever goes on top of it is a really exciting trend. And there's a great museum, for instance, in Montreal that is an archaeology museum, and it's built on an archaeological site.
Hmm. Archaeologists tend to be as poorly paid as they are highly educated. Why is that? Why is it such a hard thing for them to make a living at this thing that they love?
Okay, well, think about it. You're a CEO, and you want to show quarterly profits. Where are the profits in this? Hmm. It's like, you know, it's work, and that's one reason that I love it so much. I am interested in the jobs that anybody graduating from business school would have cut right out. I'm interested in people who, you know, they're making personal sacrifices to do this, but they're adding immeasurable and incalculable benefits to the rest of us. They're finding out things about our mutual and shared past. And, you know, I don't know where the money comes from in archaeology. I think universities and museums and sometimes governments are interested in investing in it. It certainly becomes tourist attraction if it's done right. But, I mean, you know, Poverty Point Mounds in Louisiana, for instance. You know about these?
No, tell us about them.
They're on the, cultural heritage. They're part of our prized, internationally recognized cultural heritage in the United States. They are giant earthen mounds that were created by hunter-gatherers thousands of years ago. We don't know why. They're kind of fascinating to look at if you like dirt mounds. We don't know that much about them. But what we do know is that it took a tremendous amount of effort. They were hauling a tremendous amount of dirt from a tremendous distance, and they had to all work together to create whatever this was, a meeting plaza, a kind of, you know, place of worship, a burial mound. Who knows?
When archaeologists have had to speculate on the function of something, whether it had a symbolic purpose or whether it had to do with, getting food or hunting or whatever, I mean, how certain do they act about their conclusions? Are they always aware that the things that they have definitively stated could turn out to be wrong?
Oh, yes. Most of them are saying, well, you know, sooner or later, everybody's going to find out that much of my first book is wrong. You know, you want your textbook to be revised frequently, I think. It is a very exciting time in archaeology. They are finding out incredible things every day, every week. It has a tremendous amount of the news is devoted to of the science news is devoted to archaeology, which surprises people a lot. But in terms of, you know, the bones of Homo erectus, I mean, was there a Homo heidelbergensis, or were they all Homo erectus? I mean, this is a hot question among some quarters.
How is technology, and particularly DNA analysis, changing the nature of the work?
Scientific advances are making a difference in all kinds of professions, and archaeology is benefiting disproportionately. It's fascinating. One of the people that I'm really interested in is Sarah Parsak, who uses satellite photography, satellite pictures, to find new sites in Egypt, for instance. You know, using ground penetrating radar and various advanced types of that to look underwater, to go through the jungle cover. People are finding more and more sites, and they're also being able to monitor the erosion and the looting of other sites.
My guest is author Marilyn Johnson. We're talking about her new book, Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Marilyn Johnson. Her new book is called Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Marilyn, archaeologists also have a role to play in helping to identify human remains, particularly after disasters and crimes. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned about the role of archaeologists following the 9/11 attacks?
I followed a forensic archaeology crew who were helping train detectives, homicide detectives, and archaeologists in how to capture information. And afterwards, I learned a lot about 9/11. And I think when that happened, that honestly, the rush was to clean up, not to capture information, not to gather all the fragments that could be found. And there were archaeologists who stepped forward and said, "We can help." And they were turned away. And so they managed to prove that they could, even some distance, some weeks and months out, that they could gather information and, using archaeological techniques, actually tell us a lot about the blast and about, you know, the people who were lost in it. And archaeologists have since put together wonderful collections of volunteers, and they will go to a disaster site and help and help gather up the remains and identify them. And the forensic archaeologist that I followed is also very involved in that work and in helping train archaeologists specifically in how to work in those kinds of environments.
And it makes perfect sense because they're people who have dedicated their careers to finding objects and then sort of almost putting them back together like a puzzle to figure out how they might have been used and what might have happened.
You know, there's an awful lot of hard, dirty work that is involved in the human condition. And some of these archaeologists, one of the ones that I talked to, who does this, who goes in and finds homicide victims and helps learn as much as they can about the perpetrator and the circumstances under which it happened. He's in fact in love with, the archaeology of South and Central America from 2,000 years ago. Mm. That's the kind of archaeology he really loves. But he says, you know, somebody has to do that other work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Very interesting show.
Thanks.
I got a question. That is, have y'all started 3D mapping to be able to put a lot of these small objects into a database that would be able to run a program to compare them all to see if they could find matches to things to put together?
Oh, absolutely. That kind of thing is happening. And there are a lot of archaeologists who are trying to there's a very interesting organization, by the way, called CYARK, C-Y-A-R-K. And they go into wonderful archaeological ruins and try to do very sophisticated 3D mapping of it. So in case something happens, at least a whole lot of information has been captured and possible reconstruction can be done. But also, you can get a tremendous amount of information without having to go to the site and disturb anything.
I like the idea that archaeologists probably, at least the ones who deal with ancient peoples, have extraordinary survival skills. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, you know, when you're working in a remote place, or even if you're working in your backyard, you're going to be confronted with certain problems that that, you know, maybe you don't have access to a wonderful house nearby. You don't have access to a cell phone. You don't have access to a store where you can buy things. So the people who are working in the more remote areas they're used to not having all the tools they need, and they can basically do things with duct tape and a Swiss Army knife. Cleverly contrive, pull the Jeep out of the ditch sorts of things. And you know, one of the archaeologists that I talked to said, you know, when the apocalypse comes, you really want to find an archaeologist because they know how to do, they know how to survive, they know how to build fires, and they know how to build hill forts. And it's like, well, why would you need to build a hill fort? Well, you know, in case somebody was coming after you or threatening you. It's like, okay.
And when you were in field school, you were also encouraged to learn how to make and to utilize certain Stone Age technologies.
Oh, yes. I had to learn some rudimentary flint knapping so I could make my own knife to butcher my own animal. I didn't have to actually kill the animal, but I had to be able to get the meat off the bone. And, you know, I almost put out my eye and my teacher's eye doing that. It's actually, everybody should know how to do these things in my teacher's estimation. We should all know how to build a fire. We should all know how to, how to protect ourselves if we're in the wild and terrible weather comes up. We should know how to build a little fort, a little lean-to. And that makes sense to me. I mean, you know, we're lucky we have you know, lots of options where we are in urban areas like Dallas or New York. But, you know, oftentimes when you get out into the remote areas, I mean, people get in terrible situations and try to use their cell phone to get out of it. That's not going to work.
Having that knowledge also allows you to understand the subtlety and the differences between different objects. The idea that you can pick up, you know, an arrowhead and think, okay, was this a weapon to kill animals to hunt with, or was this a weapon of war? And if you know what you're looking at, you might be able to speculate on the difference.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, if it's worn in a certain way, you know, because it was lashed onto, you know, a spear, you want to be able to know these kinds of things. And, you know, I found it really quite fascinating how many different ways a tool could be used, and someone, you know, adept at reading the tool could tell you, yes, this was reworked on this side. Do you see the little bits of, you know, hair and stuff? Then it was, you know, it was used in tanning. That to me is really, that's smart stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Robert on the line in Arlington. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Ms. Chris. I love your show as always.
Thank you.
I know we don't have but a minute. I was going to ask the professor a question about, like, for example, the aircraft that went down in Antarctica, that sightseeing plane, which was in the 80s, and it's still sitting there. I've read up on that, and I was just curious as to why it wasn't, you know, confiscated, or did they look through it, or, you know, that.
I'm not sure if that came up in your research at all, Marilyn.
It didn't, and but there are lots of situations like that where something has been just left to the elements. It's hard to know, you know, who would go out there and capture it and try to find that. Somebody would have to really mount an expedition to do that. So oftentimes, you know, that's what happens. Things just get abandoned and left. There is so much in the world to discover and find. And this is, to me, one of the thrilling things about archaeology. Oh, hasn't Machu Picchu and Stonehenge and Angkor Wat, all those places have already been discovered. What else is there? My goodness, there is a tremendous world full of things out there.
Are there sections of active sites left deliberately undisturbed so that people who have even better technology and knowledge than we do today might come back around and reanalyze?
Absolutely. Every archaeologist that I worked with, this is one of the tenets is, you know, we don't need to look ahead that far to say they are going to have much better tools in the future. They're going to be able to put little robots down in places that we humans would disturb utterly and ruin. And the little robots will be able to get the information and bring it back to us. So they all leave part. You can't excavate a whole site anyway. That's just a tremendous job. They leave it deliberately for people who will come behind them.
That does take extraordinary self-discipline, almost self-sacrifice.
Yes, I think they're very aware. I mean, more than anybody that I know of, they are aware of how very tiny part of the human history we occupy. They have the long view, and they take the long view, and they look around and they say, well, what are we leaving behind? Oh, my goodness, what a lot of garbage we're leaving behind.
How diverse is the pool of archaeologists working today, and how do different backgrounds, different genders, that sort of thing, affect the way people approach their work?
Well, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, you find what you're looking for. So you don't want to cut women out of archaeology because they bring a tremendous amount of insights into, you know, the half of the human population. And by the same token, you don't want a whole lot of white people from the United States and the United Kingdom going out into the world and telling people, other people, how they need to capture and preserve their own history. You want ideally, you want people from everywhere being involved in saving all of it. And so the field is much more diverse gender-wise than it used to be. Women play a much more active role, I think, in archaeology than they used to, though there were heroic women that you can read about from the early days. They are working very hard to get people to always to get people from wherever country they're digging be involved in it, to be shareholders in it, to take ownership of it, and to be trained as archaeologists so they can help develop it as a site that everybody in the country can visit. That's happening so beautifully in Peru, and that's pretty much my last chapter is I go to Machu Picchu with archaeologists from around the world, and I focus on particular on a Peruvian archaeologist who has really given a fantastic piece of that country's history back to itself.
How do professional archaeologists feel about self-appointed amateur archaeologists?
Well, some of them are horrified by amateur archaeologists and say, you know, that's like a homicide, like telling a homicide detective, don't worry, I collected your evidence for you. But there are fabulous amateur archaeologists out there, and all archaeologists really, I think, ultimately recognize that. The ones who are trained and disciplined and who know their place, in a sense, and who really, whose devotion is to connecting us with our history and not destroying any evidence of the past. Those are people who are just, I mean, that's a fantastic, to be a friend of archaeology in that role is quite an honor if an archaeologist extends his or her hand and acknowledges, yes, you've done something valuable.
Would you go on another dig?
Oh, of course. Are you kidding? My mother, though, cannot believe that I actually, like, put myself in these situations. She said, you never even used to go outside as a kid. How could you do that? I can't explain it. It just was really cool. It was fun to suffer. I liked sweating.
Discoveries every minute. The new book by author Marilyn Johnson is called Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Marilyn, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and in fact, she produced today's show. Our executive producer is Jeff Weddington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.